formalities here, and then we'll get to the questions. Sound good?
Sure, sounds like a plan.
Okay, so this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Major David Gottfried, recorded on March 27th, 2019 in Victoria, BC. Interview conducted by Jordy Forsyth. Major Gottfried, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
All right, so we'll just start with some background questions. Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Winnipeg. However, my dad was also in the military. He was a pilot, so I was born in Winnipeg, moved to Portage la Prairie, Edmonton, Oromocto, New Brunswick, back to Winnipeg, and then out to Calgary.
Wow, a little bit of moving around, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So primarily, though, I lived for the longest time, for 13 years in Winnipeg.
Okay, sounds good. What drew you to enlist in the military?
Well, when I was 17, I guess it was 17 or 18, my mom and dad were sick of me hanging around the house, so they got me to join the reserves. So I joined the reserves. I did 4 years in the reserves. Then I released, went to school in Calgary. I got a job right out of school, but then was laid off because I was in the oil field industry and things went bad. And I liked the culture within the military, so I re-enlisted, or re-enrolled, I guess, in 2019.
Okay.
Because I really liked the environment, so.
Right on. Was there a point that you realized you wanted to be in the RCAC?
Well, not at first, but when I enrolled, the recruiting was not as open as it is now, so there was only combat trades were open for recruitment. So we're talking armored, infantry, artillery, and engineer. I didn't want to be infantry, I didn't like the artillery, and I didn't know anything about engineering, so armored was really what I wanted to do because tanks fascinated me.
Right on, cool. Where did you first start your training?
Gagetown, New Brunswick.
Okay. Do you have any memories of your initial training that stick out for you?
Well, I remember when you're out there doing patrolling in the middle of the night, you can pretty much sleep anywhere. So I remember falling asleep in a puddle.
Wow.
Waking up in a puddle, I guess. I remember the feeling of extreme happiness and gratification and pride when you graduate phase four, which means you are now trained in your trade and you're going off to your unit and your badge, and you're given a badge. So for the Armored Corps, there's the Strathcona's Horse, the Royal Canadian Dragoons, and the 12 RBC, so Regiment Blindé de Canada, and I was badged RCD.
Cool. That's awesome. What was your first experiences with LAVs or Leopards?
My first experience with a Leopard was phase three, for when you first taught how to crew command. I was in the gunner seat, so you're down inside the vehicle looking out a little episcope pointing with a gun. I think we went about 300 meters. We hit a bump. I smacked my head off the sight, and I bled so badly nobody could tell where I was cut.
Oh, boy, that's crazy.
So yeah. that was my first experience in a tank.
Not the best first experience, eh?
No. And then later on in that phase three is when we first learned the 25mm turret, which is on the LAV vehicle. So we had a LAV 25 called the Coyote, and then the LAV 3s were just brought into service around that time. So we learned first on tank, and then we moved over to the Coyote, so the LAV vehicle.
Okay. What were some of, like, the opinions of your fellow soldiers and yours on the new LAV 3 and the Coyote when you first started using them?
Well, the LAV 3, we found that it was pretty powerful. Being in a tank, though, you realize that a LAV 3 can't go quite as fast cross-country as a tracked vehicle, especially one with 700 horsepower.
Right.
But for an infantry fighting vehicle, there was lots of space for maneuvering around. You could get from where you needed to go. It had a big enough gun that you could defend yourself against most vehicles it would fight against. So we're talking, BMPs and, other infantry fighting vehicles. All in all, we thought we liked it. I mean, we were moving towards a lighter force at that time, so it was a good vehicle to have.
Right on. So what were some of, like, the typical training exercises you'd go through in those vehicles?
So you would do, we call them training levels, I guess. So you have level 5 training, which is at a squadron or a company level, but you start off at vehicle to vehicle, so you learn how to do cooperation with the infantry and the armored and the engineers and the artillery in a combat team. and you start off at the smallest element, which would be crews and vehicles integrating with each other, learning what each other does, and, you know, basically teaching the other trade your trade. Then you go up to a troop level, which is the smallest element, then into a combat team level where you're dealing with three or four troops, three or four platoons, artillery, engineers, you know, doing that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it was interesting working with them and then watching the infantry dismount while you're out there doing your thing. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely a lot of moving parts in those sort of training scenarios. Did you find any one group more difficult to train with than the other at all?
Not really. It depends on where you are, I guess. I mean, we have three armies, really. You have the Army of the West, the Army of the Center, and then the Army in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
So Ontario, Quebec, and basically a West. Every unit within each of those brigades and those divisions have their own little idiosyncrasies. So typically out West, they're kind of like cowboys. They just do what they need to do and just don't really care about procedures and off they go. The Center is more sticklers to the rules, and the Quebec group, the Bandus and the 12 RBC, they're more in line with the French culture. So it's, they have their own little idiosyncrasies. But I mean, overall, when you look at each unit, they all generally do the same thing. They just have their own little things. But when you're talking about trades, the hardest trade I think to work with is the artillery, for me personally.
Oh yeah. Okay. What sort of things are difficult about working with artillery?
They're just a different bunch of people.
Okay.
Gotcha. That's not a very political, and it's not quite what you're looking for. It's just, there's some different, it's just different mentalities.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at an armored guy and an infantry guy and an engineer and an artillery guy, which make up a combat team, the pointy end of the stick is the infantry and the armored. The engineers are enablers, and they do routes, and they make mobility easier, so they'll breach gaps. You know, they'll fill in anti-tank ditches. We can plow through minefields, and they'll mark the lanes. So the engineers are more of a hands-on kind of group as well. The artillery guys are their back launching rounds from far away.
Right.
They have a FOO party, so a forward observation observer, and they just move with combat teams, but they're generally further back.
Okay.
That's where the guns are anyway.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. Cool. Thanks. So now we're just sort of moving into just before deployment to Afghanistan. Do you remember just after September 11th, 2001, what was the general feeling with you and your fellow soldiers after the attacks on the Twin Towers?
Well, I was actually at school in Winnipeg.
Okay.
So when 9/11 happened, I was still attending university. So when I re-enrolled, I went to the university, the regular officer training program, which is at a civilian university, vice at RMC.
Okay.
So I was all by myself.
Yes.
Really. I was working with two PPCLI. Well, not working, I reported basically to them. It was a whole lot of disbelief on my part. And it was really more unbelievable when you're sitting there driving down Ness Avenue and looking at all the planes landing in Winnipeg because they've been grounded.
Right.
That's
surreal.
It was very, very surreal. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you assume you would be deployed over there to Afghanistan?
Not immediately, no.
Okay.
In fact, I think it took a little bit of time before the powers that be made the decision to come over.
Right.
Or go over, I guess.
Yeah. Did your training sort of ramp up or change when you realized that forces were going to be deployed over?
Not for me, no. I was far enough along in the program that we still were employing tanks, so off we went in tanks. We were also currently in Bosnia, which was more of a peacekeeping mission. We hadn't gone to Afghanistan or to a warfighting stance at that time. So we were still ramping up to do peace support, peacekeeping, peace enforcement, that kind of thing. Once they made the decision to go, my battle group, actually the RCD, went to Bosnia with a squadron that went off to Kabul in Afghanistan. And that's when we started realizing, okay, this is a little bit more real, because they started taking flak jackets from us and giving it to the people going to Afghanistan.
Right.
And we were like, huh,
yeah.
Okay.
Different sort of job to do in Afghanistan than it was in Bosnia, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And then what really ended up changing for us is when I was actually at the Armored School in Gagetown as an instructor teaching students is when they started receiving casualties.
Right.
Once casualties started happening and we'd moved down to Kandahar and the fighting really began, that's when our training changed more to get people ready to go out the door. And that's when things started shifting towards that,
right,
that environment.
So you saw a shift when Operation Athena went into phase two and you guys moved from Kabul down to Kandahar?
Yeah, quite a big shift, actually.
Okay, right. Right on. So did you have any personal concerns before you were deployed to Afghanistan?
Well, sure. I mean, you're going into a war zone. We had already deployed tanks. Tanks had already been there. So when the difference between a tank and a LAV, especially when you look at the Leopard 1 when we sent it there, is about a Leopard 1 is 45 tons. The LAV is about 15, 16 tons. They were building IEDs big enough to take out the tanks.
Wow.
So what that does to a LAV is a lot worse than what it will do to a tank. So you start realizing that as much as we start building up armor, they're building up bigger bombs. And so it becomes a bit of a, well, where do they place their bombs? Where are these IEDs going to normally be placed? And yeah, you have some concern. But I mean, once you get into theater and once you're there, it's you trust your training and you go with it.
Right. So it was a quick learning process, learning how to deal with those new threats of bigger IEDs and how they were using them against your forces.
Yeah. So when you look at what the engineers were doing and how they were teaching us the tactics that we used once we got into theater and what they were teaching us to use before we went over, saved a lot of lives. Because what we would do is if we came into an area where we thought there would be a lot of IEDs, guys would dismount and walk, and you can see better when you're on the ground, and it's safer for you on the ground sometimes than it is in the vehicle driving, because you won't be able to see the telltale signs of, okay, there's an IED been in place here.
Right.
You know, there's always markers, there's indicators that you can pick up. It's easier when you're walking sometimes. And if the vehicle gets hit by an IED that's command wire, if it's missed, the people are far enough away that it should not affect them as badly as if they were in the vehicle.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm going to circle back to some of those questions later on, but we'll just sort of go down the line here. So what was your rank when you were first deployed?
When I went to Bosnia, I was a lieutenant, and when I went to Afghanistan, I was a captain.
Okay. So what could you just sort of explain to me your duties at that rank when you were in Afghanistan?
Okay, so as a captain, I was the 2IC of the squadron, so I was second in command of the unit that, well, the squadron that I was with. So we had two troops of tanks, plus an echelon and so forth. So my responsibility was almost more administrative. However, when we got to theater, I ended up going actually out to the FOB in Massamgar. So we had a battle captain. He's the guy who does the operation side of it. I was the 2IC. I would do more the administrative side of it. But I also basically became the de facto camp guy. I sort of ran around, made sure the camp was running properly, made sure that we had a national service element with us, or support element with us, making sure they were still following the rules and doing what they needed to do to make sure that we were being properly supported. We also had an Afghan National Army group with us in the camp, so we made sure that they stayed in their area. We didn't interrupt them. You know, there was a bit of segregation there. And,
right.
You did all that kind of stuff. And whenever the OC left, I basically took over.
Wow. Full days for you then, hey?
Yeah, I was generally up by 6, and I went down to bed at, well, it was about 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock.
Wow.
And when I'd go do some relaxation, I generally get about 6 hours, so it's not bad. It's pretty good, actually.
So what were some of your, like, self-care tactics over there so you didn't, you know, the stress must have been huge?
For me, a lot of it was just walking the camp.
Mm-hmm.
Put on your body armor and go for a walk. Make sure you're, you know, protected from any small arms fire or any rockets that just happen to get launched.
Right.
Which they happen to do. But, you know, you go up for a walk up to some of the OPs, and there were pretty significant hills you're climbing, so you do some PT, get a chance to do that. You know, I read a lot. Work kept us pretty busy because I did the historical documents that we put together. So
okay.
I had to do the war diary for the squadron as well. I did do 3 operations, though, as one as the OC and one as like I deployed out as with a small little group and off we did our thing. So
okay.
I did get out of the camp and I did get to see some, I actually got to see some pretty significant combat.
Yeah.
But,
so yeah. What operations were those that you were involved in?
I was on one, it was called Altar Arwa 5.
Okay.
That one was, it was a disrupt operation. So I don't know if you know the geography of how Kandahar and the Bazari Panjwa is laid out. So where Masamgar was, as you go further west down the Argandab River, you get to a small town right at the confluence of the Dowry and the Argandab called Mushan.
Okay.
So at Mushan, we had an outpost there, and it was a combat run every time you had to refuel them or resupply them. They closed it down on our tour. At the beginning of the summer, they closed it down, and then we left. So to let the Taliban know we still had freedom of movement, they put an air mobile unit in, and I was tasked with supporting the administrative company coming in with water, food for the American air mobile guys that came in. And so we came down and supported them, and on the way back, we came up the Argandab. So on the way down, it was pretty simple. I think we caught them totally by surprise because they weren't expecting us to come down the Dowry River.
Okay.
On the way back, though, we got into a 13-hour tick. So a tick is troops in contact, so we got into a firefight for about 13 hours.
Wow.
On the way back, yeah.
That's pretty intense. 13 hours of fighting is a lot.
Yeah, it makes for a bit of a long day. I mean, it has its moments, right? There's lulls, there's high intensity. It's, yeah.
Right. Okay. I'm going to also circle back to some of those operations questions again, but just a few questions about deployment and, like, again, when you first arrived. What was the process of transporting the Leopards from Canada or Bosnia to Afghanistan?
So to get the Leopards into theater, they had to rent Globe. Well, they flew on Globemasters.
Okay.
I think they rented the planes from the Americans. I don't think we had the actual Globemasters in our service yet. But they were flown in one at a time into theater, into Kandahar Airfield.
Cool.
No, I lied. They were up in Kabul, so my mistake. They landed in Kabul, and then they drove them from Kabul down to Kandahar.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a journey.
Those were the Leopard 1s.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So those were the Leopard 1s, and when we purchased the Leopard 2s off the Dutch and the Germans, those were flown directly into Kandahar.
Okay. And those Leopard 2s, those were purchased in 2006, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So can you describe your first day in Afghanistan, like maybe your first impressions, new culture, which base you were in?
Yeah. So when we first come in, we flew through Dubai. You land there, you go off a civilian aircraft and you get put into a Herc or a Challenger. Well, we flew in on a Challenger, so at that point they had them. So then they fly in, and depending on your pilot, sometimes they'll combat fly in, so they'll drop down and maneuver and get you quite airsick.
Right.
But that was after 18 hours of flight time. So we did Edmonton, Quebec City, Munich, Dubai to Kandahar.
Wow.
So that was our flight in. And when you first got there, it's just you're overwhelmed with smell. It smells dirty because it's a camp that doesn't have, don't forget, they don't necessarily have indoor plumbing. They don't have a lot of the infrastructure that we do. And they had a pond. It was the refuge pond or whatever, and it was awful.
Yeah.
The heat is one thing that gets you. And it wasn't even hot then. It was only like plus 30. So coming out of Edmonton, because I went over to Strathcona, so came out of Edmonton. It was April when we flew over, so it was still rather chilly, like 5-6 degrees, and then you come over there and it's 30. It was just like, yeah, it's interesting. And then what you do is you go through some indoctrination training. So they give you your weapons, so your rifle. For me, I got a pistol as well. You bring those over with you, you get them all in, hook them up, make sure they're all secured. You do, this is what IEDs look like. This is how you look for IEDs. This is how you do plotting if you have to. This is where the interpreters come from. This is the medical procedures in case there's an IED incident, a strike, or whatever. This is how you go through those procedures over the radios or what you should be doing. Now, you did about 3 days of indoctrination into where you were. which was interesting. And then on about the third day is when you were put on a chalk and flown out to, for me, we were all flown out to Fob Masamgar. So we got on a Chinook and we flew out, and that's when you're like, we're not in Kansas anymore, because you're flying over the Reg Desert and there's nothing there.
Right.
Like it is barren. It's a pretty, that again is surreal. You're just like, okay. And you get in there and you have you're the new guy in town. So you have that nice shine to you, and you go see the guys who have been there 6, 7, 8 months. And they're just like, okay, just get me the hell out of here. They know what's important, what's not important. Their techniques have, they've already realized what's a real danger, what's not a real danger. You know, they're a bit more seasoned and they're more veterans, I guess. And
did
you arrive in Massam? Sorry, go ahead.
Did they like sort of help you guys get acclimatized? The guys who'd been there for longer, or were they more just ready to leave?
Yeah. So we would do a patrol. So what they would do is they do a familiarization patrol. So what we did is we left Masamgar, we drove all the way up Route Summit to Fob Wilson and just passed there to a mountain range, and we set up an actual range where we fired the tanks, just so we could get used to being, okay, these are the tanks, here they're making the noise again. The labs were doing the same thing. They'd set up barrels, you'd shoot the barrels just to get yourself acclimatized, this is what the territory looks like. You can give you a bit of a familiar of what things are going on. All the traffic that's driving by, where the people are walking. You see what an actual wadi system looks like and why it's so dangerous. But it's you're kind of on pins and needles going, okay. And the guy you're with is just like, yep, okay, good.
Yeah, and then eventually would become... You'd feel like that and then do the same thing for your replacements on the next roto or whatever, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. The dark humor that you get it makes you kind of chuckle now.
Right, yeah.
People would be worried about you.
Yeah, exactly.
I would surmise, yeah.
Yeah. So I've heard about the hurry up and wait kind of part of the conflict. How did this come into play in the early days and during operations?
Well, I mean, combat is generally, you know, 90% boredom with 10% sheer terror. So that's the hurry up and wait.
Right.
Or we're going, get ready to go, and you sit there while something gets sorted out, and you got to wait, and then you go. So it's, I can't talk to other tours because our tour was a lot different than some of the previous ones. We weren't as spread out, and we were doing a bit of closing down for our tour as some of the earlier tours, where they actually deployed out. They'd go to Leaguer's at night, so they'd spend the night outside the wire and then move around and eventually come back. They weren't tied to a FOB. We were more tied to a FOB.
Okay.
A forward operating base.
Right.
I mean, for us, we were a part of the quick reaction force. We had a troop that was always there, and we had control of the quick reaction force in Masamgar. And in a 180-day span, they deployed 180 times.
Wow.
So you sit there, you wait, you hear a boom, people start getting ramped up, get ready to go, launch the QRF, go see what's going on, do a post-blast exploitation, or go rescue somebody. We had to rescue a couple of Americans a few times because they drove their trucks into a wadi system.
Yikes.
It's you sit there and you wait for the next thing to go boom, and then off you go.
Right.
Or you wait for a report, and then, you know, the battle group will launch the QRF, and then you go do your thing.
So, like, a constant state of readiness, basically.
You always have a unit that was always on 30 minutes notice to move.
Wow. Okay.
Always.
Yeah.
There's always somebody ready.
Huh. Okay. How are leopards, like, used in that quick reaction force?
Non-traditionally, so they weren't used in a traditional sense where they would lead an attack into anywhere. For the most part, it was forced security. So they would lead. We had rollers. So if we ever left the road, we'd put the rollers on and we'd roll where we were driving. So rollers are weights at the front of the tank. They're actually wheels that have a lot of weight, which is designed to detonate an IED or an anti-tank mine before it hits the vehicle.
Okay.
So it would prove the route. You would drive along and everybody else follow the track. So we use that as well. It was also a bit of a deterrent because they're big honking vehicles.
Right.
So, and they have a big gun.
Yeah. Deterrent by like view from other people.
Yeah.
Hey. Okay.
Yeah. So it's like a show of force. Like, okay, you've got an AK-47. I've got a 120mm cannon.
Right.
Go hide behind your wall. I'll just blow up the wall.
Right.
Do what you will.
Yeah.
But that was where we were kind of relegated to for one of the troops. The other troop was siphoned off to join with companies to do missions or do operations. So we did a couple of operations with B Company. We'd go down to Spur Wingar. They'd get into a little bit of a dust up. We'd fire a couple rounds and then off we'd go. You know, everybody would be happy and we'd come home type thing.
Right.
You know, there's a couple of deliberate ops down into, I did a feint in Housie Madad. So a feint is basically you drive where you're going, you pretend you're going to go somewhere, then you stop just short of being committed in an attempt to draw people's attention away from where you really want to attack from.
Okay.
So we did that once. I did that once. Yeah. So, but they were, for us in my tour, that's how we were used. When the tanks first came over and they were still doing heavy combat, they were used in the traditional sense in infantry armor combat, where you would have a combat team, they'd form up, they'd line up, see where the enemy is, and they would advance and go forth and destroy.
Okay.
So they were doing traditional tactics from World War II in Afghanistan before the Taliban or before they changed their tactics and didn't try to stand up one-on-one with us.
Right. Okay. So I just want to ask a question about those rollers you were talking about. When did those come into play? Were they like issued as soon as you guys got there, or did they?
They are part of a squadron. A squadron generally will have a roller. Each troop has a roller tank and a dozer.
Okay.
Sorry, not a dozer, a plow. There's one dozer per squadron.
Okay.
So every four tanks will have a set of rollers and a set of plows.
Okay.
And that's so you can breach minefields.
Right on.
Because, you know, the enemy will put obstacles. And this is tactics that go all the way back to World War II. And we still employ them because they're still effective tactics.
So those rollers,
we had them already.
Okay, you had them already. Yeah, they were in use before you guys were in Afghanistan. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
So could you speak on some of the advantages of using Leopards over Lavs?
Well, Leopard has obviously got a bigger gun.
Yeah.
So there's lots of instances where the Lavs would be firing at guys behind grape hut walls or mud walls, and the rounds would just bounce off the walls.
Okay.
They would just get embedded in the walls because, don't forget, they're about 2-3 feet thick, and it's really, really compacted mud. So they didn't really have a lot of impact. The Leopard 1 has a 105mm gun. The Leopard 2 has a 120mm gun. You can fire a round at it and blow a manhole size in the wall.
Right.
So for a breaching capability, you could do that. You could just stand off, not have anybody near there, launch a round in from a kilometer away, create a big hole in the wall, and anything else behind that is eliminated. You put two rounds in the side by side, and you get a vehicle size hole you can drive a vehicle through.
Wow.
So you don't have to go down a road, or you don't have to go down where you would suspect there would be IEDs. You can go from in wherever you want to, where they won't have had a chance to set booby traps or whatever. And anything that's generally there will have been detonated as well. So you're sort of doing a clearing by fire.
Okay. So the direct fire capability against an insurgent enemy was beneficial for the Leopards, hey?
Oh, yeah, very, very much so.
Okay. And what about maneuverability with the wadis and the grape fields for the tracked vehicles? Were they more beneficial than the Lavs in that regard?
Depending on the season. So when we got there, it was just at the end of rainy season. Nobody was going anywhere fast.
Right.
If you went off-road, it was really muddy. It was really wet. Tanks, Lavs, didn't matter. Nobody had great mobility. When it was the dry season, so when we left, it was October, everything was hard as concrete. There was no problems with mobility. When you get into the grape fields, they're deep, deep ditches, so you'd have to plow them. You literally had to plow them to make them flat so you could get across them.
Okay.
If you didn't want to use the roads, and we tried not to use the roads because that's obviously where the IEDs were all placed. I mean, they were placed just about anywhere, but the road is the primary place where they would put them.
Right. Okay.
I mean, we plot a road. So when I was down in Mushan, we were setting up, we were at a Liger, and we were moving to a landing zone where the infantry guys were going to get helicoptered out. The troop before us created a combat road, secured the LZ, then we followed up, and in the hour it took us, the hour between when they left and when we left, they had set up an IED at a wadi.
Wow.
They had already set up an IED on the road that we had just built.
That's quick.
And by built, I mean we plowed it, yeah.
Huh.
So it was interesting because we were doing, at that point we were doing actual tactics where the infantry were walking behind the tanks. Because they didn't have labs with us down there, but they did have trucks, so everybody was walking and doing the normal thing. So it was a nice, it was a very traditional tactic that you would see.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Okay. So were you paired up probably with an engineer squadron then when you guys were building those roads?
Yeah, we have, there's things called armored engineer vehicles. They're called Badgers. Well, we call them Badgers.
Those are the ones with the bucket big, on the front and the scoop?
They got the big bucket. Those things are probably the most important piece of equipment on any battlefield.
Really?
I would surmise, yeah.
Huh.
Because they can plow, they can take that bucket, they can fill in any ditches, they can do just about anything. And if you have a good operator like we did, they can get a breach cleared in about 10 minutes.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and so what they also have, they also carry things called fascines. So if you want to put some stability in there, you take the fascine, drop it in the ditch, and then you just pull the mud that they generally leave on the other side down onto the fascine, and you create a breach that way.
Cool.
Yeah.
So it creates easy access that can be used by labs and leopards.
Labs, leopards, B vehicles, so trucks, right. if you have time to prepare it a bit better.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Absolutely.
Were there any common mechanical or tactical issues that sort of arose with leopards? Like anything like blowing tracks off or something that would just, you know, happen and you guys had to react to and deal with?
For us, the biggest thing, I'll talk from a maintenance point of view.
Okay.
For the leopards in the labs, the biggest thing was because the dust was so fine, the filters they had, the air filters they had, were not really ready for that amount of dust. So you get a lot of overheating, not only because of the temperature, but you get a lot of overheating of engines and systems would shut down in your vehicles, both the lab and the leopard, because it was so hot. At one point, that 13-hour tick I was telling you about, it was plus 63.
Wow.
That day. Yeah. Inside the tank was about 80 degrees.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
How did you guys come and adapt to those, the air filter issues and overheating issues?
You just change your tactics, your TTPs, so tactics, techniques, and procedures. So okay. When you do your maintenance, every time you stop on a vehicle, you do maintenance on it. Every time we'd stop, we'd clean out the air filters.
Right.
You had to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was a bit of a pain for the driver because he's the guy who'd have to do it. But, you know, if you didn't do it, the vehicle wouldn't run. And so that becomes a problem when you've got a 70-ton paperweight sitting in a river.
Yeah.
And that you're not allowed to leave.
And dangerous, too.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah.
Okay. If you could have changed anything about the way leopards were used in Afghanistan, what would you have changed?
That's a good question.
It's a bit of a big one.
I'm not sure. It is a bit of a big one, and it's, you know, I'm by no means a tactician. I can give you my opinions of tanks, but how were they used? We did something a little bit different in our tour because traditionally when you deploy anywhere with a squadron of tanks, there's three troops, and within those troops, there's four tanks. So you're generally deploying with about 15 tanks when you take into account the command team of the squadron. We only had two troops. So what we ended up doing is we ended up doing more of what the Russians do, is they had three tank troops. So we could create three troops instead of just two with three tanks each.
Okay.
It kind of gave a bit of a break to some of the guys, and you could do more things. It became a necessity because of the lack of people we had and the lack of – well, basically the lack of people because we had enough tanks.
Right.
So – it was an interesting thing that my boss at the time did, is to help out the battle group. I don't think where we were operating with the tanks was conducive really for what they're made for. Tanks are for long range engagement, and then you go in and do support for the infantry when you do close range engagement. So it was very difficult to do long range when nobody would ever leave the built up areas.
Right.
So you didn't really find massed enemy in the middle of a field.
Yeah.
And so there was really nowhere to go, so it was a bit of a tough thing. But
yeah, you couldn't really use the traditional tactic of a tank to fight this insurgent enemy that is very mobile and stuff like that, hey?
Well, yeah, and I mean, if you think about it, you're taking a big tank, 70 tons with four people, to try and find two guys with an AK-47 that are shooting the weapon over the wall without exposing themselves. You can't even see where they're firing from. But you know, if the goal is to get protection for the crew, the tank is it, because it has enough armor to beat most everything.
Right.
Although they did build IEDs big enough to blow up tanks, but
right. So your main threat was gonna be IEDs. They didn't have any sort of light armored vehicles of themselves. The enemy, hey.
The only thing they had was an 82 millimeter gun.
Okay.
It's called a recoilless rifle, and it fires a sabot dart. So a sabot dart is just a big piece of metal that flies at high speed. And that was our biggest direct fire threat. And we had one guy who was killed with a lucky shot from an 82 millimeter recoilless rifle.
Wow.
It hit a screw hole, which is a weak point in the armor, and it burrowed through where the screw went, and then it got into the crew compartment.
Wow. Typically that wouldn't happen, hey?
That's like a million to one. Like, I can't even give you the odds. It's just an incredibly unlucky shot for the driver.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. That's unfortunate, but usually the armor would be able to stand up to that.
Yeah, and for us, the biggest threat was IEDs.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, small arms on a tank is really, yeah.
Yeah. It's like shooting a .22 at a steel plate, basically.
Yep.
I'll scroll down here. So I understand the Canadian forces in 2003 wanted to ramp down their use of Leopards and switch into Lavs that were produced in Canada. What did you think about this decision?
Well, seeing as I had just finished training on Leopards and I really liked tanks, I was not for it at all. We had started drawing down the tanks. We had actually put out a divestment order saying we are divesting the Canadian Armed Forces of tanks. They're big, they're heavy, they're expensive to maintain. I wasn't a fan. I thought, you know, we're the armored corps. What are we going to do when we have the same vehicle as every other corps? So what's going to be our distinguisher, right? We're masters of maneuver warfare. You're basically taking my identity and, you know, putting it on a shelf.
Right.
So I was not really impressed.
Yeah.
Let's just say.
Okay. Yeah, it's a difficult thing to have happen. So you were pretty excited when the Leopard 2s were bought from Germany and kitted.
So when you think about it, when it started, we had a big parade in Petawawa. We drove the Leopards out of Petawawa through Pembroke to the train station. So we had basically a freedom of the city with the tanks, where we drove them through Pembroke, through Petawawa, and you know, we got a big send off, and we thought, okay, we're done.
But wow!
At that time, you know, Afghanistan wasn't really kicking off. I mean, it was just starting to. We were just starting to see our commitment to Afghanistan wasn't that big at that point.
Okay.
So at that time, at the regiments, we're like, well, we're never going to see tanks again. We're never ever going to buy new tanks again. It wasn't until we started seeing casualties coming out of Afghanistan and the public was like, well, this is unacceptable. And we had one general in particular, from my understanding, he pushed and pushed and pushed until General Hillier said, okay, get us tanks, who was CDS at the time.
Right.
And from a procurement cycle, we're still paying for how fast these tanks came in, but from a procurement cycle, it was a minor miracle or a major miracle. From the word go get tanks until we had tanks in theater and fighting them was 6 months.
Wow.
Considering I'm in the procurement world now, and considering it takes about 10 years for a project from, you know, flash to bang, you know, hey, I have a capability gap, and here's the capability I am to replace it. It's about 10 years.
Right. That's
everything goes smoothly.
An impressive amount of time to make that happen.
Yeah. Fortunately for us at the time, the Dutch were divesting all their tanks. They were selling them off. So we bought a bunch of Dutch tanks, you know, and we've got new armored engineering vehicles. We've got new armored recovery vehicles. We bought 120 platforms, of which we made 100 tanks, and the 18 were AEVs, 12 were ARVs, and then the rest were tanks.
Okay.
So 82 tanks total.
Yeah. So basically there's the safety of the troops over, you know, the economic benefits of building labs in Ontario.
So there was that one. And they also had, I don't know if you've ever heard of it, Operation Medusa.
I have, yeah.
So Operation Medusa was a catastrophe from our point of view, from what I've heard. I wasn't there, so I can't really say.
Okay.
But my understanding is, when you look at where Massimgar is, right across the river was a white schoolhouse. And the white schoolhouse has become synonymous with us is because that's where we had a lot of casualties there.
Yeah.
We could not cross the river because we didn't have anything that could defeat the wall, the mud walls. We didn't have anything powerful enough. So from a tactical point of view, if we had tanks, we could have sat there across the river out of anybody's range, obliterated that schoolhouse and anything in there, and then rolled across the river, no problem. But as it was, it became a massive life and death fight. And, you know, people died.
Yeah, so tanks would have mitigated that risk initially.
It would have been a big mitigation because we could have just, the tanks could have obliterated that whole line, just pumped rounds into there, and, you know, not a lot's going to survive.
Right. Yeah.
My point of view, and, you know, that's hearsay, of course.
Yep.
But,
that's good to know.
But from my understanding is there were, if we had traditional tactics of infantry tank cooperation, that would not have been as hard a fight as it was.
Right. Okay. That's good to know. Yeah. I've actually done a bit of reading on Operation Medusa. So going forward, do you think LAVs will continue to be used as an armored vehicle in the Canadian Forces? And do you think Leopards will also continue to be used in our, just going forward in future conflicts? Do you think there's a home for both of these vehicles in the Forces? Or are there better technologies on the horizon?
So I'm going to give you a long-winded answer.
Okay.
So we learned a lot of lessons in Afghanistan, some of them good, some of them bad. A lot of them not necessarily where we need to go for the fight of the future. We learned how to fight a coin or a counterinsurgency kind of war, and we didn't necessarily remember our maneuver warfare background or our maneuver warfare mantra. LAVs will always be in our forces. They are our vehicle platform of choice. And we will always be a medium weight force for this foreseeable future with a heavy capability in the tank to fight, because we are, based on Prime Minister Trudeau's direction, is we are going to go more peacekeeping and more peace enforcement. It's kind of a nice thing to say, but to get to peacekeeping, you have to get peace to begin with. So you have to do a fight to get to a peaceful environment. The lab right now, we have the LAV 6. It's a bigger vehicle. It's a heavier vehicle. It's got the same firepower. It's a pretty decent vehicle. It's a bit bigger than I think we need. Well, not need, but we should have. But for what we're doing and for how we're going to go forward in the future, it's the vehicle we have, and it's always going to be there until, you know, for another 25 years.
Okay.
Leopards depends on the world environment, right? We can deploy however much we can deploy. We don't have a large amount of tanks. If we have to fight the Russians, if we have to fight anybody with a heavy armor, we're in trouble. Well, NATO's in trouble, to be honest with you.
Yes, right.
Will we deploy tanks again? If we're asked to, yeah. Do we have tanks in Latvia right now? No. All our labs are in Latvia. We have a battle group or a brigade group in Latvia that has the way of the future is cooperation with other allied nations. So it's all going to be joint. Right. So we have a brigade there that has Polish troops, it has Latvian troops, it has British troops, it has U.S. troops that we're in command of. But yeah, so the LAV is going to be key for us going forward, and we're going to maintain that because it's the infantry fighting vehicle, and it gives them the protection that they will require moving forward. Because before they had an M113 and it couldn't stop a 9mm pistol. So.
Right.
And they have at least a defensive capability in the 25mm that if they come up against another vehicle, they can at least scare it, do damage to it if it's a small vehicle or whatever. At least they have some defensive capability. So that is what we're going to do. Will we ever go back to track? From a business side of the house, we won't because it's too expensive.
Right.
We had the CCV coming in, but we canceled it because it would have been too much. And that's kind of like a Bradley. It was a tracked infantry fighting vehicle.
Okay.
Tanks depends on our political masters and where we go with that. I think we'll always have a need for tanks. I swear if we ever got rid of the Badgers, like, there'd be a mutiny. They're the best piece of equipment ever and they're tracked.
Yeah.
But Leopards, I think we need to meet our NATO commitments, and I don't think they're going to go anywhere anytime soon. We may park some of them to maintain them and, you know, preserve them, but we'll always need to be able to do that cooperation with the infantry, artillery, and engineers.
Right. So there'll be a need for everything across the board, but it might be more LAV specific depending on future conflicts.
Yeah, our first deployed vehicle will be a LAV always.
Okay.
Or TAP-V now.
Well, could you expand on what that is for me? Sorry.
Oh, sorry. The TAV is a tactical armored patrol vehicle.
Okay.
You would have seen pictures of them roaming around Gatineau.
Oh, okay.
Flooding happened last year.
Right.
Those big four-wheeled vehicles that,
yeah.
We bought 500 of those, and they're now with the troops.
Okay. So. Yeah, I think I remember those.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. I think that's sort of... It. I really like that last question. Is there any other topics, memories, or significant details that you would like to share for this interview?
Well, I don't know. I could probably talk forever. But.
Anything's good. I wouldn't mind hearing a bit more about like sort of your daily routine as a captain on like running that base. You know, just
well. It,
you wake up at 0600, and then what's your next move?
Well, mine was pretty dull. I'm not going to lie to you. I'd wake up, I'd go do PT, then I'd go get breakfast, and PT would go for the walk, right?
Yeah.
Then you'd read all the daily reports coming in, because you did have to back up the OC. So you look at all the intelligence reports coming in and see what's happening in your area, make sure there's nothing's going on. Any administrative, we had a tank hit an IED. We had to repatriate two people. That was my responsibility within the squadron to get them back to Kandahar and make sure that they got safely back home.
Yeah.
I got to listen to a lot of the gripes. I was the sounding board for a lot of people to vent. And, you know, I took that on as part of my role because, you know, who else are they going to vent to?
Right.
I like to think I was kind of even though I had a temper sometimes. The sober second thought and let them do their thing and let them vent. And you meet people sometimes when they come in off the helicopter and you acclimatize them and welcome them to the FOB. Make sure people knew where they were going. You almost like a concierge almost sometimes. But you know, I'd have to go to meetings. The NCE would hold meetings, so the National Support Element, they would hold meetings down there and talk about combat logistics patrols coming by and what was priority, and I'd have to pry the battle group and say, listen, I have a need for these parts. I need them to be on that logistics patrol coming out of Kandahar, you know, and I'd be the liaison between the battle group and the squadron and that kind of stuff. You'd have to keep some people in line. We'd have to go around shoot dogs because there's wild dogs, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, disciplinary things as well. You mentioned working...
Thankfully for us, we didn't really have any disciplinary problems.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Yeah, we got kind of lucky.
Nice. That's awesome. You mentioned working with the ANA and then with other, the battle group. So that, the battle group, was that other countries that you would have to be working with?
So we went over with the Tuvalu battle group. So that's, they're out of Quebec. So I always was within a Canadian battle group.
Okay.
The operation I went down to Mouchon with is we were under command of an American battle group. So we supported an American operation down into Mouchon, and we were flown in by British, American, and Canadian helicopters.
Okay.
Or they were flown in by British, American, and Canadian helicopters. And I basically took command of the small support element because I was a convoy escort primarily, or basically, and then we went down and did small little engagements with the enemy while they were down there doing their thing.
Okay. Did things sort of have to change while you were working with the states? Differences between, you know, operations and communications or anything?
Well, the biggest problem was their communications equipment. We had problems linking in with them.
Mm.
Because they have a different, you can get into the technicalities of it all, but their radios sometimes wouldn't talk to our radios.
Ah.
So that was the problem there. However, once we were moving around and doing our thing, because we're pretty much do the same thing, we're a little bit more crazy than they are, they think. during the tick, we were supporting all of them, and we were getting their people through this line, and they... you know, we're just rolling around in tanks shooting at things. So they're just, yeah, we had no problems integrating with the Americans at all.
That's good.
They said, what are you bringing to this fight? And I told them what I could do. And they were like, okay, go do your thing.
Right on. That's good.
So, you know, it's interesting working with them because the amount of resources that the Americans have, they did a show of force. So a show of force is taking something and saying, I have this big honking thing. So they did a show of force with a B-1 bomber at 500 feet above us.
Wow.
So I don't know if you know what a B-1 bomber is. It came down, flew 500 feet off the ground and said, hey, I'm right here. Quit dicking around. And then they dropped a 500-pound bomb.
Wow.
Right on a, and you're like, Jesus, Louis. Like,
yeah.
Because it's an American operation, they have all their own assets. They don't have to worry about the task force.
Right.
They just brought their own stuff in and said, okay, well, I'm going to drop a bomb here.
Yeah, one of the largest militaries in the world.
It is the largest military in the world, yes. That's not true. I apologize. Yeah.
As for working with the ANA, was that difficult, the language barrier, their tactics or anything like that?
It is a very different culture.
Yes.
They're a lot about self-preservation, and primarily because they don't, that's how they're raised, right?
Right.
When the OMLIC guys worked with the ANA, the National Army, they got some very good people, and they got some very good soldiers, and they did some really good work. You know, they're in a really tough spot because if they found out who their families would have been killed.
Right.
But, you know, it was difficult working with them because of you never knew what their commanders were going to do, even though you're training them to do things a certain way. We had money going to Haji Baran, who was the district chief, and he would just pocket the money. The district chief of police would just pocket the money and not pay his men. They were coming onto our fob and stealing our gas.
Wow.
The Afghan police were, yeah.
So, difficult position to be in.
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to do the right thing, but they've got their bosses are corrupt and, they, you know, they flat out. Anyway, it's just the culture over there. It's just how they survive. Right. So it is what it is.
Yeah, for sure.
But, I mean, you know, when we went down the river, we had a patrol with them. They lost... They lost four guys in that river, so they had a mortar round land on the back of a truck where guys were sitting. So
wow,
they're out there doing the thing, they're living it. So yeah. you can't say anything really bad about them.
Right, yeah, doing their job.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that's all I have, unless you have anything else that you want to share or any points you want me to include.
No, that's it for now, I guess.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do this. Just going to do the... This concludes the Military Oral History Interview with Major David Gottfried on March 27th, 2019. You've signed the interview release form, correct?
Yep, I've emailed it to you already.
Okay, thank you very much.